The Chief Executive of Cricket Australia, James Sutherland, and we certainly appreciate the time he's made available to speak to us on the eve of what promises to be a history-making summer of cricket. And I'd also like to welcome from Cricket Australia the Chairman, Craig O'Connor. Some of our major sponsors are with us today. We have Kim Hume, General Manager of Telstra, Simon Langbein from Malaysia Airlines, David Egan from Deloitte. Now, you're enjoying some wines there from our wine sponsor, Pernod Ricard, and beers from SA Brewing, and as with all our sponsors, and including Amy there, the Press Club appreciates your ongoing support. Don't forget the raffle, some tickets there on your tables, 3 tickets for $5. We have a host of prizes here, as you can see. We have a prize from Telstra, some a collection of books, and please dig deep, buy those tickets. And just a reminder that for members of the media who'd like to question James Sutherland, if you could please register your intention to do so with Joanna out the back of the room. It's a system we introduced recently, and it certainly has worked well. So if you could do that for us before James starts speaking. Thank you for your attention. I'll be returning shortly to introduce James. Okay. Look, I'm sure our guest today wouldn't mind me saying that as a first-class cricketer, James Sutherland makes a very good administrator. He played a handful of games for Victoria in the early 90s, but in the past 7 years, he's made his name as a leading light in the game, both here and in internationally. As a great cricketer, though, he enjoyed outstanding success with Melbourne University. He took over 400 wickets, bowling fast medium, and looking at the height of the man, no wonder he was successful. Only one other Victorian bowler, that was Sean Graff, achieved that milestone. Now, he's a qualified accountant, and his first move into sports administration was with the Carlton Football Club. But he'll be the first to tell you that his allegiance in football lies down Geelong way. Hasn't wiped the smile off his face. He joined the Australian Cricket Board as commercial general manager in 1998 and found himself embroiled in a bitter pay dispute with the players. Well, the board must have thought he'd done a pretty good job at dealing with that because he was elevated to CEO 3 years later. He's also a member of the ICC's Chief Executive Committee, responsible for administering the game at the international level. And I guess they just have one or two issues on the go at the moment. Many hold real fears of a racial divide in the sport. Some of the crowd behaviour in East India recently was certainly disturbing, and that's led to warnings to Australian fans. Then, of course, there are claims of discrimination in umpiring circles, and it'll be fascinating to see where Darryl Hare's career goes once his re-education is over. And add the simmering issues of rebel tours, players' complaints about too much cricket and the impact of the 2020 game, and I'd suggest James Sutherland has plenty on his plate. But he's undeterred by the challenge and was heard to comment recently that he had plenty of reasons to bounce out of bed every day. Well, James, you've bounced your way into Adelaide today. We're certainly delighted to have you and we look forward to hearing from you.
Thanks, Grant. Thank you for the introduction. It is great to be in Adelaide with the smell of cricket in the air. I should acknowledge, and he was welcomed earlier on, the presence of the Chairman of Cricket Australia, Craig O'Connor, who obviously lives in Adelaide, as you probably know. I said to him when he found out that I was coming to lunch to speak at this lunch. He told me that he was coming to the lunch and I said suggested to him that I thought he'd have much better things to do than come and listen to me speak, given that we talk on the phone every single day. And he said, well, we'd normally go to lunch on Friday afternoon, and it seems like as good a place to be as any. So here he is, and I also want to acknowledge in the room members of the South Australian Cricket Association, including the Chief Executive, Mike Dear. Grant, it was nice of you to be so complimentary about my first-class cricket career. I might just add a little bit of extra detail to that, if you don't mind. I was a fast medium or even medium fast bowler, depending on how you wanted to look at it. But the emphasis was on the medium. And I was really the type of bowler that batsmen like to sledge. It was a pretty short career, and the fact that the highlight of that career was actually being 12th man in the Sheffield Shield final, which Victoria won, gives you a pretty decent indication that there weren't too many highlights. But I'd like to just dwell on one particular highlight, if you don't mind, and that's the fact that the last wicket I got in first-class cricket was none other than the captain of the Australian cricket team, Ricky Ponting. It was a long time ago, and Ricky was a very young man, as you could imagine. But it was at the MCG, and it was Ponting, hit wicket, bowled Sutherland. Now, the mirth that's coming from those of you in the room, you're obviously thinking about that fast rising delivery at the head, and the batsman, Ponting, doing his very best to avoid injury or perhaps death by getting out of the way and falling on his stumps. Well, it didn't actually happen like that. It was a short, wide one outside off stump. Ricky pounced onto the back foot, and in his excitement of hitting the ball through the offside field for four, misplaced his right heel, stood on his right stump, dislodged his right bail, and there it was. Ponting hit wicket, bowled Sutherland, and the Victorian selectors of the day said, it's time this bloke moved on if that's the only way he can get his wickets. And I did. given we're here today at the Adelaide South Australian Press Club, I want to just for a moment dwell on the really important role that the media plays in our sport and I guess the independent relationship that Cricket Australia and all Australian sporting organisations have with the media. It's a relationship that's very much founded on public interest, and it's something that is of mutual benefit to both parties. Cricket itself benefits very much from the media. Over 70% of our revenue comes directly from television rights. Television rights that are sold here in Australia to the Nine Network and Fox Sports, and overseas to television networks in India, South Africa, England, and other parts of the world. That revenue is really important to us, and the truth of the matter is that our sponsorship revenues, which are also very significant for us, don't come without that television exposure. The media also benefits from its relationship with cricket, and obviously cricket is a sport that the public is interested in, and therefore it sells newspapers. It drives television ratings, and in this digital age it drives extra clicks on the internet. The relationship's big for us as an organisation. We are currently in the process of reviewing requests for accreditation by over 1,400 members of the media from here in Australia and overseas for this coming summer. It's in fact more requests for accreditation than we had last year in the bumper Ashes summer. In terms of responding to the huge media interest, we have great challenges. We've got nine staff in our public affairs department that almost primarily deal with coping with, servicing with the constant demand of the media. And that's challenging, but it's our role as well. It's important that we find the right balance and to deliver on what is a formal policy of the board to provide honest, open and timely information to the Australian public through the media. And I guess that transparency that is a policy of our organisation, from my perspective as Chief Executive, makes my job a lot easier. It's a position that we don't think twice about. It's a position that we take consistently, and I think a recent, very recent example of that approach is it can be seen in the recent launch of the book, The History of Australian Cricket, or the Australian Cricket Board. The book's called Inside Story, Unlocking Australian Cricket's Archives. It's written by David Frith and Gideon Haig, and it was launched last Monday. The Cricket Australia, in allowing the book to be published, provided those authors with unrestricted access to the archives of Cricket Australia. So every minute book, everything that we have in our archives was presented to those two gentlemen to put together a full, frank and fearless account of what has happened within the walls of Australian cricket over the last 100 years. It makes for some pretty interesting reading, but I think that it's an example of that transparency, and it's with it, I guess, comes a decision from within the board to say, well, if we're going to publish our history and we're going to ask someone to write our history, it's not worth reading unless it's what has truly happened. And so from that point of view, it's a pretty good example of that policy. There's a couple of weeks to go, as many of you will know, till the first test match starts in Brisbane, and the Sri Lankans have arrived here in Adelaide, and there's a match tomorrow, a Chairman's 11 match starting tomorrow as they look to get an extra hit. They've actually requested this match. This match has been quite sort of hastily put together. It wasn't in the original program. The Sri Lankans have decided they'd like to come in a little bit early and to have some extra practice, and no better place to get practice than here in Adelaide. Murali's in the news straight up, and whilst I'll talk in a moment about the potential crowd response to him, one of the big stories about Mathai Muralitharan is whether he will take the 9 wickets that's necessary for him to go past Shane Warne as the biggest wicket taker in Test cricket history. This summer has an anniversary about it, the 25th anniversary of the first ever Test match between Sri Lanka and Australia. And incidentally, for those of you in the room who are not trivia buffs, that first Test match against Sri Lanka was the Test match in which David Hooks made his first ever 100 and only 100 in Test cricket. How many was it? How many runs? 143 not out. Matches between Sri Lanka and Australia have over the years had plenty of edge to them, and I don't expect it to be too different this year. From our perspective in the Australian team, it's going to be very interesting to see how Andrew Hilditch and his fellow selectors put together the Australian cricket team for that first Test match. We've lost Justin Langer, we've lost Shane Warne and Glenn McGrath, and there are a number of names in the mix. I think the Australian public's very excited about seeing young talent coming through, getting the opportunity to put their names up, and you think about guys that we've been excited about for quite some time, people like Mitchell Johnson, Sean Tate and Ben Hilfenhaus in the fast bowling department. All of them have done bits and pieces over the last couple of years that make them very well credentialed to come through. That in itself is a very interesting battle for selection. And the spinning side of things, you've got the veteran in McGill, and then you've got others, two South Australians, Dan Cullen and Cullen Bailey, as examples, perhaps not necessarily pushing for test selection right now, but at the same time, very much under the microscope, and more under the microscope today than they ever have been before. There's big expectations for those two young guys, and now is definitely the time for them to be stepping up. And opening the batting, everyone's got their hand up for that spot, and that in itself, taking Justin Langer's position in the team, will be very interesting. Langer will be very difficult to replace. Anyone that's got 20-odd test hundreds like he has, and has been throughout his career very much an underestimated player, will be a huge loss to the team. But the loss won't be anywhere near as great as the 1,271 wickets that's lost through not having McGrath and Shane Warne in the team. And I think I don't think we've really come to terms with that fact. We won't come to terms with that until we get into the middle of test matches and we're finding that 20 wickets are quite hard to take. And there aren't many test matches won by teams that take less than 20 wickets in a game. And so the reality for us is that we have to find guys who are going to take the wickets. And when you've got Warne and McGrath in your team, like we've had for the last 10 or 15 years, it's going to be very difficult without them. And that's where the role of the selectors is very challenging. That's where the role of our coaches is challenging, to try to find that talent. If you want a bit of a picture of what the future might look like, cast your minds back to 4 years ago when India played Australia here in Adelaide. It was a test match that India won, and I'm not saying that India are going to win. I'm just saying that the Indian test series 4 years ago was extremely hard fought. Shane Warne was actually suspended at the time, so he wasn't in the Australian team. And wickets for us were more difficult to come by. In fact, the fourth test match saw Australia go in Sydney with a 1-0 lead, and we narrowly escaped a drawn series by being a close test match that it was a draw in that last game. And so it could be tough, and I think the test matches may well go a little bit longer in the coming years. From an Adelaide perspective, just as it is all over Australia this year, it's going to be a huge summer. 50 days of international cricket, which is as much as we've ever had before. Adelaide itself will see the Chairman's 11 match, which starts on Saturday. A Chapel Hadley one-day match against New Zealand on the 14th of December. A test match returning to its traditional date line on Australia Day, which is incidentally a national day in India as well. It's Indian Independence Day on the 26th of January, which makes for a special occasion in itself. And the Commonwealth Bank series then returns to Adelaide in February and March. But I think interesting to reflect, one of the things that has happened, this is more cricket than Adelaide has ever seen before, and I think from that perspective, you cricket fans in Adelaide should be very pleased about that. It's to some extent a reflection on how well representatives of the South Australian Cricket Association have lobbied with Cricket Australia over recent years to have matches, more cricket at the Adelaide Oval. It's been an aggressive approach. It's been an offering in many respects. There's been consideration to have more matches, and from that perspective, the SACA has offered more than others have to ensure that the South Australian public can get some more cricket. And I think that's a real positive. But with that comes some expectation, and the expectation is a fulfilment of the promise that South Australian people will turn up at the cricket. South Australian people will come and fill the Adelaide Oval and watch these matches. And so to some extent, the rest of Australia is watching to see whether that response is as positive as people are expecting. I guess with that expectation comes a hope that for those people who are in the media today, in this room today, a hope that your support of cricket in South Australia will be forthcoming, because it's in the interest of your state to continue to have international cricket here in as much abundance as we're going to see this summer, and so your support will obviously be much appreciated. Cricket provides great content for the cricket fans of South Australia, but it also pours big money into the economy. And one of the things we did last year during the Ashes series was we did an economic impact study of what contribution the Ashes tour made to the whole Australian economy, and it was something like $320 million of contribution to the economy. In Adelaide alone, $58.5 million was poured into South Australia. We didn't get a breakdown of how much the Barmy Army contributed compared to others, but obviously they were here in force, and created a brilliant atmosphere, drank a lot, ate a lot, and made a great contribution to what was a memorable test match. The Barmy Army, the Swami Army, whoever it is, there are annual pilgrimages that happen coming to this Adelaide test match. I've got a lot of mates in Melbourne that always put the Adelaide test match in their diary, and they, as a matter of course, come over for the test match. I can remember when I was playing cricket at Melbourne University, the negotiations between Melbourne University and Adelaide University cricket clubs of trying to ensure that the tour to Adelaide every year coincided with the Adelaide test match was almost a mere formality, but an absolute must for those Melbourne University players that wanted to be here for the occasion. I touched on before the arrival of the Sri Lankan team and a lot of the speculation and conjecture about crowd behaviour. The cricket hasn't started yet, but to some extent the controversy has. In fact, there hasn't really been any controversy. I think it's been tremendously overplayed thus far. There's a lot of public discussion about crowd behaviour and the risk of racism. I guess in the perspective of the game of cricket and at-match behaviour, racism is a subset of the overall issue of crowd behaviour. And I don't expect there to be any real difference this year to what we've seen before. We're expecting big, noisy, boisterous crowds at international cricket matches all over the country. They'll all be expressing their own view or their own version of what is a welcome and reminding people that they're not here for a holiday. That reminder will be extended to international players from the countries that visit here. That reminder will also at times be extended to players from interstate who may have a position in the test side that the locals don't think is warranted or not ahead of perhaps some local talent. That's just part of coming to the cricket, and that's just part of how it is. And it's all fine. It's all part of the sport. But there is a line that is drawn there, and provided that public behaviour doesn't cross the line, then it's all acceptable, good-natured stuff. And really, for us, the underlying message is that we want people to come along and have fun. We want them to enjoy their day at the cricket. But if someone's idea of enjoying the cricket is ruining someone else's fun or ruining someone else's day, then it turns out to be something else. And they're the people that we don't want at the cricket. And that's really important. The thing for us now is that we are taking an approach, an integrated approach to planning crowd behaviour. It's actually not so much about crowd behaviour, it's just about spectator fun, spectator enjoyment, spectator comfort. We want people to come along and enjoy their day at the cricket, and we're taking a more formal approach than we ever had before. What we will do where people find themselves getting into the position of crossing the line is that we will identify them. We will locate them in the ground, and we will remove them from the ground. Detect and eject. That's what we're going to do, and that's what we need to do, because if people are ruining other people's day at the cricket, then we need to remove them from the ground so people can go on and have a good day. There won't be anywhere to hide, and that's the approach we need to take for the good of everyone else who's there. On the racism side of things, again, I think the issue has been overplayed in recent times. I think the response in the Indian media has been interesting and significant. It's probably been even built up as being an even major issue, more major issue here in Australia. I don't expect there to be issues here in Australia. I think it's well understood where the lines are drawn. There's a policy in place. People understand what the ICC anti-racism policy is, and from our position, it's a simple, easy to understand policy. There were some very minor, isolated incidents that occurred during the South African tour 2 years ago. I have great confidence in the Australian public, in their understanding of where the lines are drawn, and we enjoy and respect people from all different cultures, and I'm sure the Australian public will welcome them here this summer. One minor bit of detail just in that off the back of that detect and eject approach. It's a lot easier for us to take the detect and eject approach when we actually know about it on the day. And so from that perspective, we're encouraging people to do something that others might not ordinarily do in Australia, and that's actually to inform people of people that are crossing the line. It's easier for us to do it there and then than to find out the day after when people ring into a radio station or they ring the SACA and complain about something that happened at the game. We need our people at the ground to complain on the day and for the officials at the ground to be able to make the appropriate action, take the appropriate action at the time. We take what we do in respect to racism very seriously. It's a major issue. It's a sensitive issue. It's a complex issue. But we do take it really seriously, and we will be taking it really seriously this summer. The longer term issue for us, though, is really about making sure that the game of cricket integrates itself into the whole of Australian society. And to that end, ensuring the game of cricket is accessible to all Australians. Our vision as a sport, as an organisation, is to be Australia's favourite sport. That means we need to be a sport for all Australians, a sport for men and women, for boys and girls, for people of all different ethnic backgrounds in this country. And we all know and understand that the changing nature, the changing demographic of Australian society is there amongst us in our daily lives. And for us to be the sport we want to be in Australia, we need to continue to find a way to be accessible to everyone. Richie Beno, in the foreword to the Cricket Australia History book that I referred to earlier on, said the following: "There is, though, something about cricket in Australia that has always held firm, that any youngster with a skill and right temperament will always be given the chance to play for his country, and to do so with distinction, irrespective of the walk of life from which he might come." And so for us, in an operational sense as an organisation, our focus is really getting down to grassroots level, getting down to the children of Australia to ensure that they grow up with bats and balls in their hand and having good fun doing that. We want our kids to grow up with the opportunity to enjoy the performances of the Australian cricket team, and an Australian cricket team whose members include people wearing the baggy green cap, who might be Indigenous, Asian, Islamic, or other backgrounds. It's something for us all to look forward to. The real challenge for us as sports administrators is to find ways in which the game of cricket will be strong in 15 or 20 years' time. And my personal view is that an assessment of what sort of job we do as administrators today can only be properly made in that time, in 15 or 20 years' time, because today's kids, today's primary school kids, are tomorrow's consumers. And they're also, obviously, tomorrow's Australian cricketers. And if we're strong on the field and off the field in 20 years' time, then it will be a good reflection as to what we've done off the field at grassroots at this time, both in schools and also amongst the community. And finding that right balance is really difficult. The SACA are absolutely committed to that objective as well, and I think you should be proud of the fact that within the South Australian Cricket Association you have some of the most innovative and thoughtful leaders in this game development area. As a side note to that, 5.9% of the South Australian population between 5 and 39 age group are playing cricket. That, in comparison to the rest of the country, is very high. It's the second most, only behind Victoria. So per capita participation in this state is as high as any state apart from Victoria. And the SACA are not in any way resting on its laurels. There is, I know, a very aggressive program going on at the moment with development officers focusing on ensuring kids are playing the game. 500 schools are being visited in these couple of months leading into the start of the international season with an aim of getting bats and balls in 70,000 kids' hands. I'm happy to take some questions from the audience in a moment. I just wanted to touch on a couple of things very briefly before I finish up. Firstly, 2020 cricket, it's big and it's only going to get bigger. As you probably know, it's designed as a bite-sized piece of entertainment that is comparative in length of time to a movie or the theatre or a football match even. And from that point of view, has held some great attraction. It's designed to appeal to new markets, and it's done that pretty well. Interestingly, the World 2020 Championship match that was the final match that India won in South Africa a few weeks ago was had the greatest television audience of any television event in India ever, which in itself is a sign of how quickly, in a matter of weeks, the Indian public have responded to 2020 as a game. I remember the first ever 2020 match I ever saw was here at the Adelaide Oval. Australia A played Pakistan, and it was a great experience and a wonderful event. I remember walking back from the game back into the city with a guy who's about my age, but I would describe as a cricketing purist. And he was reflecting on the game. I said to him, what do you think? And he said, yeah, I can see how some people might like it. It's interesting. You know, there was all that music and stuff like that. I wonder, do you think we have to call it cricket? And that in itself describes many people's response to this form of the game. But even after the 2020 World Championship, I think there are many people out there who are traditionalists, purists, but I think they're shifting in their seats. They're shifting in their view. And whilst they might be remaining wedded to their long-term affection for Test cricket, they're perhaps coming to see a way in which they might have a flirtation on the side with 2020 cricket. We've got big plans for 2020 cricket, and they'll hopefully unfold over the next year or so. It'll mean that the KFC Big Bash, our 2020 domestic competition here, will gain even greater exposure, and from that perspective also perhaps even an international context to it with a Champions League, an international Champions League to be developed and hopefully launched next year. I want to touch on India very quickly. The game of cricket is absolutely huge in India, and I think you all understand that. In terms of the global cricket economy, over 70% of revenue for the game is generated out of India, and to that end, it's extremely important. The 2020 match that I went to in Bombay on Saturday night was an amazing experience. The Indian public are just all over this game. I've never seen a build up to a game in the media like I had. Certainly not in India. There were just pages and pages of features about 2020 cricket, and I had the interesting experience of sitting in a box or a viewing area where there was about 100 people, and unbeknownst to me, I only found out later, there were Bollywood rock stars or movie stars that were some of the biggest names in Indian film. Everyone seemed to be turning around looking at them rather than watching the cricket, but the sheer nature of this 2020 game is such that everyone wants to be there, and those Bollywood superstars were certainly there. I also had suffered the embarrassment at the game of having the vice president of the BCCI about four times during the course of the Australian innings. We were chasing, you may recall, we were chasing and it quickly became apparent that we weren't going to win the game. And four times in the course of probably the last 10 overs, he yelled across at me in front of all these people saying, "James, don't feel so bad. You are playing against the world champions." So they were very excited. I've never seen a man so excited as the vice president after the game. The other thing, just as a sideline to that, the influence of India is really significant all the way around the world. One of the ways in which that's being felt is actually in the United States, where there is a huge population of expat Indians. The television rights market in the world is obviously, number one is India, but the second biggest market at the moment is the United States, ahead of the UK and South Africa. So that's a decent indication of where, or the influence of the Indian subcontinent. The last one I just wanted to touch on is Sir Donald Bradman and the fact that the 27th of August 2008 is the 100th anniversary of his birth in Cootamundra, and that's obviously a significant date, worthy of celebration by cricket fans all over the world, and perhaps particularly here in South Australia, where he called home, or Adelaide, where he called home for most of his life. Sir Donald is Australian cricket's greatest participant. He was obviously the greatest player ever, but more than that, he gave most of his life to the game as an administrator after having played as well. It's probably too early to tell exactly the ways in which we might go about celebrating that significant occasion or anniversary, but there are lots of thoughts going through our head at the moment. One of them is perhaps we should be having a public holiday. If it's good enough for Melburnians to have a public holiday for a race, a horse race, then perhaps it might be good enough for people in Adelaide to do that. Certainly, I guess, without wanting to ignite any sort of Republican date, if it's good enough for states to celebrate a birthday for the Queen, then it would be good enough for most of us to celebrate a public holiday for the King of Australian cricket, or indeed the King of Australian sport. On that note, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to finish up, and I'd be only too happy to take any questions that you might want to pose to me. Thank you.
Okay. Some questioners there. Yep. This microphone just up there in the back of the room, please.
Hey James, Richard L from the Advertiser. Look, is it a concern the BCCI anti-racism officer doesn't believe in the anti-racism code and called Andrew Symons a liar over his racism claims?
You know, I wasn't familiar about the calling Andrew Symons a liar. I think the BCCI has responded in a fashion through their president making statements around about the racism policy. We also saw in Mumbai action taken by the BCCI in removing spectators who had contravened the regulations within the policy from the ground. And I think from that perspective, we saw a positive response. It might have been a delayed response, but it was a positive response. Ultimately, it's the ICC's policy, and ultimately that's a matter now that's in the hands of the ICC in terms of the investigation that they're conducting. The facts of the matter are that whatever's gone behind us, it's really important that all of us look ahead and deal with this as a matter of principle. There's no place for racism in our sport or any other sport. There's no place for racism in society, and we all need to commit to that.
Dean Dowling, retired physics. Look, Jeff Marsh, 45 cans of beer that he used on the trip to the old country. He was carried off conscious flight in a wheelchair.
Now, I didn't realise Jeff Marsh was such a good drinker, but...
No, but there was a better one, Booney one eventually, and I forget the other one. Yeah, it's in, as he had older, getting outside of the, anyway, it's in the that book. Now the point is that obviously the alcohol affected his cricket ability. Now, but he wasn't suspended for 2 years. Now, how is it that the cricket association and so on are suspending for 2 years anyone, any cricketer using illicit drugs, which are far safer in every respect than alcohol? Alcohol causes permanent irreversible damage and aggressive behaviour. All the other cannabis and so on are passive behaviour drugs. How does the Cricket Association justify giving 2 year suspension for cricketers who use illicit drugs?
Well, I think as a sporting organisation, we take the approach, firstly, in respect to illicit drugs, they're obviously illegal, so that's a reasonably good starting point to draw a line and say that you shouldn't be dealing with those. I think, secondly, the other aspect of anti-drugs policy ties in with performance enhancement, and that's an issue that is now directed around the world through WADA, through the anti-doping authority, the world's anti-doping authority. We as a sport, dictated to by the Australian government, have to subscribe to WADA, and that's the approach that we adopt. In respect to your references to alcohol, that's obviously not something that is illegal. It's something that people can consume of their own free will. I don't believe that we have a problem with alcohol. The Australian cricket team, Australian cricketers don't have a problem with alcohol. They receive training and education on appropriate behaviour, and I spend a lot of time with our players, and I can assure you that those sorts of days that you're referring to are long, long gone.
But look, how does taking heroin and cannabis and cocaine affect their cricketer's ability? What's the effect? I mean, people get drunk. They can't play cricket. They're obviously paralytic, like Marsh. And
sorry, you've had your question.
Do you justify gifts?
No.
2 years.
Can we move on, please? Are there any other questions, please? Thank you.
Hi there, Michael Owen from the Advertiser. You mentioned before that the issue of racism in cricket was overplayed, but was that referring to the media overplaying it, or the Indian cricket and the Sri Lankans, or Andrew Simons? Who are you referring to in terms of who was actually overplaying?
Well, look, I think it's been overplayed through the media, because if you go back to the South African issue 2 years ago, or you refer to those specific incidents in India, they're isolated incidents that need to be dealt with, absolutely. But you're talking about a very small minority, and all of a sudden we've turned it into an international incident. Now, I'm not for one moment saying that this isn't a sensitive, difficult and really significant issue. Absolutely, racism is. But all of a sudden we've created some sort of public expectation, even incitement, to suggest that this is going to be a huge issue this summer. It was suggested last summer that it was going to be the case. The Australian crowds were going to turn on Monty Panesar and deal with him inappropriately. It didn't happen.
I just wonder if Cricket Australia was deliberately playing it down, that's all.
Not at all. And as I said earlier on, Cricket Australia is absolutely right behind the ICC's anti-racism policy. In fact, I was one of two chief executives co-opted onto a committee to redraft the policy 2 years ago after those incidents with South Africa. We're not trying to play it down. We're just trying to ensure that people understand exactly where the lines are drawn, and so that people can come and have fun at the cricket.
So, sorry, just one question. So does that actually mean that there is an issue that needs to be addressed? I mean, you're acknowledging there is an issue, but it's not perhaps as bad as it may be.
There is an issue in society with racism. That's why if there wasn't an issue, there wouldn't be policies. But at the same time, the perspective that we have is that the Australian public will come to the cricket and enjoy their cricket. They'll make a noise, they'll have a lot of fun, but they know where the boundaries are.
Yeah, James, Mike Maguire from the Sunday Mail. I'm just given the participation levels of SA cricket you mentioned before, do you think there's a particular reason why the Redbacks have been so bad over such a long time?
Well, those kids will come through in 15 years' time, won't they?
We can only hope.
I think it's difficult. To some extent, this is a question that gets asked a lot as I go around the country of what states can do to improve their level of cricket, the level of performance in their team. I think the South Australian team has a really good blend of youth and experience and some real talent in there. I think the key focus for them right now is to get some of their key players on the park and ensure that they're all going in the same direction. And from that point of view, I suppose the other thing that comes with it is that they're in a tough school. It's as tough as it gets playing state cricket. Below the international level, playing state cricket in Australia is as tough as anywhere in the world. And there are a lot of very, very hungry cricketers out there. Perhaps that hunger hasn't been there as much as it should be. And I'm sure that's something that Mark, in his position as coach, will be looking to turn around.
Rex. Rex Joy, the Advertiser. You've spoken aggressively about the 2020 game and the one-day game and so on. When we look at sponsorship of things like basketball and baseball and many other sports, Australian rules, I guess, is there a future for the five-day game, or is that, in a an historic sense, going to become a dinosaur? Do the kids of today want instant gratification with 2020? And is the five-day game going to disappear, or do you see a long-term, commercially stable future for the five-day game?
It's a good question. I think if you have a look at all of our indicators, we would say to you that Test cricket has never been stronger in this country. That's not to say it's strong all over the world, but over the last 4 or 5 years, the Australian public has wholesomely embraced Test cricket. The interest in Test cricket is very, very strong, and our attendances have gone up and up and up, in spite of the fact that the Australian cricket team has played pretty well dominating cricket throughout that period. But the brand of cricket the Australian cricket team's played and the brand of cricket that other teams have played, I think, has really drawn people to the game, to Test cricket. Now, that's, if I just put that aside for a moment, the other part of your question is about other one-day cricket and 2020 cricket. I think from our perspective, in a strategic sense, I suppose, I think it's important that we don't offer 2020 cricket in such a way that it cannibalises our existing sport or versions of the game. And it's something that we're very, very much conscious of. We don't want to play too much international cricket. In fact, the ICC has regulated that no more than 3 matches can be played in any one season in any one country. So there's a real lid all around the world. There's a lid on 2020 cricket to say we only want to play so much. But we do see that it's a great opportunity for people to come to state cricket and see 2020 cricket through the KFC Big Bash. If you have a look at the final last year of the KFC Big Bash, was at the MCG, 30,000 people came to that game. Now, that's about 30,000 people more than normally come to a state match. And from that perspective, it's really exciting for state cricket. Our average crowd last year for the 2020 matches, state 2020 matches, was 12,500. And so from that perspective, we can see, and it's in the audience analysis we do, it's a real family environment. And if that's bringing new and different people to the game and families to the game, then we want to actually use that to complement Test cricket and, in fact, bring people across to the international game as well.
Can I jump in with a completely different question?
No,
Murali has got a real chance of breaking Warne's record. Do you think that the crowd response is going to be positive or negative? And what would Australian cricket do to perhaps acknowledge his feat if he goes beyond 708 or whatever the figure is?
We'll probably think about how we might acknowledge it if and when he gets over that hurdle. But I'm sure that Australian crowds will respond to Murali positively. He's taken 700 wickets in Test cricket. He is one of the great players of all time. And we all know that. I mean, personally, from my perspective, I can sit for hours and watch Murali bowl. He's an absolute marvel. And I think that the Australian public will recognise that. The fight that a batsman faces playing against him is similar to the fight a batsman has when they're facing Shane Warne, and it's a joy to watch that challenge. I'm sure there'll be a real positive response. I'm sure that crowds will make their noise and as they do, but at the same time, cricket lovers all over the country will really appreciate Murali for what he is, and that's an absolute champion.
James, I've got to say that Tim Lane addressed this luncheon a few weeks ago, and his view on Muralitharan was that, without reflecting on him as a bowler, his view was that in years to come, that history would not look kindly on cricket's administrators. I think it's only fair that I ask you to respond to that.
There are lots of reasons not to look kindly on cricket administrators, but you can only deal with the facts, in my view, and the facts of the matter are that in this day and age, the ICC has taken an approach of putting some science behind determining the fairness of bowling actions. The reality is that Murali's been tested upteen times, and the reality is that no matter what people may how people may interpret or view his action, the reality is that there are laws of the game and there's science that is now applied to the laws of the game in such a way that he has over and over been tested and to be found to have a fair action. As far as I'm concerned, that's the end of the story.
I mean, does it bother you that seemingly, according to Tim Lane, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of cricketers on the subcontinent trying to imitate him?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't bother me. The reality is you can only deal with the facts or the laws and the application of the laws that are available to you at the time. And if that's the case, those bowlers that come through in 10 or 15 years' time who have based their bowling ambitions or career ambitions on Murali and his bowling action, they will be subject to the tests of the day. And if they're not there or they're not fit, then they'll obviously be found out.
One more.
James, Ian Drummond from Nowhere in particular. Do you think Darryl here is getting a fair go?
Darryl Hare has had a tough time of it lately. He's and in many ways so has the ICC board and administration in dealing with the issue that I assume you're referring to. You can make all sorts of judgments on the incident, the specific incident in the Test match between Pakistan and England, where this all started. You can make judgments on the way in which the matter unfolded over the last many months to where it is now. I personally don't really want to dwell on that. I'd rather look forward from where I sit, and I've said this before. I think Darryl Hare is an outstanding umpire, has been an outstanding umpire for a long time, and where he finishes up or what he does in the future, time will tell. But I've also said that at some stage in the future, I see there's a role for him to play, you know, with umpiring in Australia, whether that's umpiring again in Australia or whether that's helping our umpires to develop their skills better.
Thank you, James. Kindly put your hands together for James Sutherland. James, just... I don't need to remind you that everyone's an expert when it comes to cricket. And there's never a shortage of people willing to tell you what's wrong with the game and how it can be improved and who should be in and out of the test team and which umpires are good and which ones are bad. The list goes on and on, but no doubt you'll have some testing times ahead this summer, so let's hope you're just as eager to jump out of the bed in a few months' time as you are now. Thanks again for speaking to us today, and please take away a bottle of the local product.
G'day.
G'day. Thanks again. We'll move on quickly to the raffle. Jody. Jody Blewett will help us with the raffle. Hang on, we got a heap of tickets all together last time. Now, first of all, we've got a nice prize there from Telstra. Cordless phone, I think. Go for it, Jase. Not allowed to draw your own.
We've got D46, Trevor Ellis.
We're going hard for that. I've already got a phone. Now, courtesy of the advertiser, we have Moments in Time celebrating 100 years of South Australia in pictures. So,
I swear I didn't look. Jars.
Now, Jars, are you in here? I'm sure they can do a reprint.
If I'm not, you start.
Okay, the carton of beer. I'm sure you are, Jars.
I'll be Jars.
Got no name. C18. Red C18.
Red C18. Red C18. Okay, it's Ricky Ponting's book, Captain's Diary, coming up.
She's got JB? D62.
It's the green one. D62 JB, is it? Are we up? Judith? Judith Bleachmore. A few more books here. Joseph Pinder's The Power Play. Certainly not about cricket.
Red C2.
Simon? Simon Langbine from Malaysia Airlines. Well done.
Thank you.
Now, we've got five the tickets in quick succession here. Again, courtesy of the advertiser, Fish SA.
Okay. Red C72, Red C3. Barry Phillips, Red C61. Red C55, Chris Red Gold. Red C49, Tim Langman.
Christian language.
We done?
That's it. Thanks, Jody.
Thank you. Thank you again, everyone, for today. Thanks again, James Sutherland. If you haven't already left your name with us, please leave your business card on the table outside and we'll put you on our mailing list. Thanks again for attending today. Enjoy the rest of the day.